Kanga Audio.
A quick thanks before we start the show. Filmmaking Confidential, the book, is getting rave reviews from readers, filmmakers, film professors, and even people in creative fields other than filmmaking. I just want to say thank you to all of you who ordered it and for your support. If you haven't yet picked it up and you want to learn my filmmaking secrets, Filmmaking Confidential is for you. It's available wherever books are sold in most countries around the world. Order by visiting Audible or Amazon. To find out more, check out filmmakingconfidential.com and stevebalderson.com. Thank you. I'm Steve Balderson, and you're listening to the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. Each week, we meet with filmmakers, writers, actors, artists, and other notables. Many episodes include questions or commentary from other filmmakers listening to the conversation. Today's guest is cinematographer Hanuman Brown Eagle. Hanuman has filmed more than 300 commercials in over 50 cities from Los Angeles to New York. He's also captured in motion more than 60 short films and music videos, as well as numerous feature films. His work has garnered over 40 awards and has been screened at festivals worldwide, including the Cannes Film Festival in France. When I sat down to visit with Hanuman, we began with why he leans toward the job title cinematographer and not director of photography.
Are you a cinematographer or are you a director of photography?
That's a great question. I don't have many cinematographers that I look up to, but there are one or two. One of them is Vittorio Storaro. He shot Apocalypse Now, among many other films, and I got to hear him speak, and he was actually really adamant about it. I'm not going to spend this whole time talking about other cinematographers, I promise, but here we go. He made the adamant point that there's only one director on a film, and so he prefers the title cinematographer, and I tend to agree with that. I'll take whichever title I'm given. I'm not picky, but I do think he's got a point. There really is. There's one director on set, and that's for a reason. So cinematographer is probably what I lean towards.
All right. Good to know.
Yeah.
When did you know that you were interested in light and space and capturing it either still or in motion?
Got it. Yeah. Well, I'll rewind just a little bit. You know, I started to know that I wanted to work in film at about 5 or 6 years old, and started to do projects. You know, I did a stop motion animation music video when I was about 7 years old, and by the time I was 12 and then 13, I produced two documentaries at 12 and 13. I thought for a long time that I wanted to be an editor. It wasn't until I got my first job in production at a production company where I was exposed to the art of lighting. I had learned a lot about camera work. I had learned a lot about editing. I'd learned a lot about directing and acting. I even acted in a film when I was 8 years old, 16 millimeter short. So I had some exposure, but it wasn't until I was about 19 years old that I first got to see what lighting was really all about. And then that's when I started to teach myself lighting. So that's 19 years ago.
So were you ever professionally schooled in the art of cinematography? Like, did you go and get a degree in cinematography?
No, I did not. No, I was lucky enough to have a father who was an independent filmmaker, and I learned a lot from him. And then I was able to parlay that knowledge and experience into an entry-level position in the field, but I never went to school for it. Yeah, I mean, continuing education for me was actually aviation. So I became a private pilot and then instrument rating, and then started working on the commercial pilot's license, at which point I decided that I wanted to do something more creative, went back to my love of production, found a job, and I've been working in production ever since. I went freelance in 2006, so I've been self-employed since 2006.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I've told people before, I learned more about how to be a director on the very first day of directing my first film, Pep Squad, than I had in any of those years at CalArts or prior. Experience teaches you more than anything else.
Yeah.
Were you ever inspired by, you know, like when you started doing it, was it just because that was around you, your dad was doing it and things were taking shape in that way? Or were you like watching a movie and say, God, that looks great?
Oh, so yeah, I was first inspired by stories, I would say. I was never directly inspired by lighting until I got a bit older. But early on, what brought me to it was a love of movies, for sure. I mean, that's movies, storytelling. So lighting for me is like an extension of that. It's, you know, being in service of the story. In service of the story that the director's telling. So that's kind of how I got into it, and that's still where the motivation comes from.
Well, let me ask you then, because I typically, as a director, Hahnemann and I have worked together many times. He's shot several of my features, and so we're familiar with each other, but I'm not familiar with working before another director. So here's my question. So for me, the camera work and the positioning of the camera and the rhythm of the shots and the composition of the image is as important, if not a little more important, than the story or the acting or the dialogue or the structure or the whatever. Now, talk to me a little bit about that, because in when I approach a scene, I approach it in that way. If you're not with a director who is too particular about the image, how do you approach it with them? Or are all of the people you work with typically pretty focusing on the image?
That's interesting. So you're claiming that you focus on the image. I would have never known that about you, because you seem so focused on the story and the performance. Your focus on the image flies under the radar. It's interesting though, because I'm coming at it from the other direction also. I'm focusing on the story, even though my job is to make the image. You're focusing on the image, even though your primary job is to tell the story. I find that fascinating. I think for me, there are films that I love that look terrible. And I definitely feel like on some level, cinematography is dispensable. You got to have good sound. And I'm sorry, everyone, that my sound's not better, but that's because I'm not a sound guy. But yeah, I think for me, there are a lot of films that I love that don't look great, and it really is story that I'm attracted to, and it's what motivates my choices. You know, I'm still obviously trying to create something beautiful, but that beautiful thing is not, it's what I am able to suss out of the director. It's what I'm able to, my job as I see it is to get inside of the director's head, see the film the way that they see it, and then execute that vision. So no matter who I'm working with, whether they've never directed a film, whether they are a very talented visual director, whether they're a cinematographer themselves, you know, either way, my goal is the same. It's just sometimes it's easier depending on who I'm working with. My goal is the same, and that goal is, yeah, like I said, to figure out what is the director's vision and to put that on the screen. And, you know, with someone like you, it's very easy to find out what you're looking for and get it. You know, someone who's more green and doesn't understand as well as you do the visual medium, you know, there are more tricks that I have to employ to, you know, kind of shake it out of them. But it's either way, it's my intention to always create the director's vision as opposed to bring my own vision to the table.
Well, I was interested to ask you that also, because I've heard from some people who think that, or have been told somewhere along the way in some class or some school, that the cinematographer is the one who decides where the shots are.
And where the camera goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I will make suggestions, but only a couple a day. And only when I feel like it's necessary. And it rarely is necessary. There are very few wrong choices. You know, it really is about director's vision. And I think for me, part of director's vision is the director decides where the camera goes. Now, the director doesn't decide where the lights go. And that's where I do get a lot more creative freedom, I would say, is for the most part, I'm deciding where the lights go. Very rarely is the director deciding that. But I'm making those choices based on what I understand the director is trying to convey.
Totally. And to go back to a point you just made a little bit ago about visuals versus sound, we've touched upon it a couple of times in some previous dialogues with people. But if the sound is inferior, you lose the audience because they just can't make it. It could look pristine.
Right.
And if it doesn't sound perfect, it's not right. And if you look at something like Blair Witch or Inland Empire, you know, the Lynch movie, what I look at them is that's just the canvas and the choice of painting material, right? So if I handed you a high 8 video camera or an, you know, 8mm cassette tape video camera, and we went out to go shoot a movie, you would still treat it the same way that you would treat shooting any other movie. It would just be that the medium of it or the texture of the, what we're working with, the canvas, is different.
Absolutely. I agree completely. And to that end, I'm way more concerned about what lighting and lighting control tools that I have than I am about what camera I have. You're right. I mean, the camera provides the texture. It provides the parameters of capturing the image. But as long as you're in tune with what camera you're using, then that will indicate, you know, how you will light a scene, how you will control the light. I mean, certainly, you know, better, newer cameras make that job easier for sure. The art of it, the creativity comes from lighting design as opposed to the capture medium. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Tell us what, this next section, I don't know how to approach it exactly, but it's about the other day I had a consulting client email me and ask me the question. It was a very interesting question. The question was simply, I would like to buy a camera to really give it that cinematic look. Which is the camera? Some people say Blackmagic, some people say Red, some people say whatever. And I responded to him and I said, you know, it's not the camera that makes it. It's the person operating the camera who knows how to use the camera who's making it. But then talk to me also a little bit about the acceptable cameras. If you were to deliver a project to, say, Netflix or Showtime or HBO, isn't there something like this? There's a list of approved cameras?
There is, but it's a questionable list. I mean, you know, if Martin Scorsese decided to shoot with a camera that wasn't on Netflix approved list, I'm pretty sure he could get away with it. I mean, I don't think that even though there is an approved list, basically what that list comes down to is they want you to shoot 4K resolution. And that is kind of a common standard at this point. But even then, you know, a lot of cameras don't shoot that resolution and still, you know, are winning Oscars. So it's very hard to say that there are really any hard, fast standards. I mean, I would generally agree with what you're saying. It's about the person using it more than it is the device itself. You know, I always crassly say that the best camera is the camera that the producer or the client is willing to pay you for. I mean, they very often, producers and clients will come with, you know, an expectation, oh, we need to use this camera. And my response typically is, okay. I don't believe that it matters a great deal. And I think every day we get closer to a point where you could spend less and still create a plenty cinematic image, plenty of resolution, plenty of latitude in terms of exposure latitude. I mean, basically each year there's a breakthrough. Each year it gets better. Each year cameras get more sensitive to light and the resolutions get higher, data rates get higher. So if someone came to me and said, what camera should I buy? I would say, well, you know, first of all, do you have clients that have an expectation for a specific camera? If you do, then you better buy that one so that you can rent it to them when you work for them. But beyond that, you know, if it's just about the quality of the image, then the question becomes, well, how much money do you want to spend? And whether they want to spend $1,000 or $100,000, there are options in those categories, and they're all quite a bit closer in quality than they should be based on that range of price. I think one thing I would suggest to people is to think a little bit more about your lens choice than you do about your camera choice, because lenses offer quite a bit of creative impression. You know, I mean, if you buy a camera that allows you to change the lenses, then you can shoot different projects with different lenses, get different looks out of one single camera.
Well, and that's a good point that you brought up the lenses, because did we shoot that music video on anamorphic lenses?
Yeah, even though the aspect ratio is 4:3, and anamorphic is ultra widescreen, 2.35:1, we took a center crop of the anamorphic lenses just because they have such a soft, dreamy kind of look to them. And we weren't even, the big thing with anamorphic lenses are those very noticeable blue horizontal flares. We had none of that. So really the only reason we were using the anamorphics was just to get that softness and that kind of painterly look that they offer. But yeah, I mean, really, I think it's great when you can afford to choose the lenses based on the project.
Describe to us, and just if we have no knowledge whatsoever, of the kinds of lenses and maybe ones that you've used that surprised you, or ones that people could readily afford and get that they might not know are good lenses or something like that. Just the basic types.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way to start is to say there are two types. There are spherical lenses and anamorphic lenses. And anamorphic lenses actually capture a wide image and squeeze it into the frame so that later when you go into post, you have to unsqueeze it. You get this stretched out, very, cinematic, traditional Panavision kind of look. But then, everything else is spherical lenses. And spherical lenses are just, that pretty much encompasses all other lenses. And there are very high-end, very expensive cinema spherical lenses. But then there are also still photography lenses that can be repurposed for video. And if a person is trying to get, more bang for their buck, starting with still photography lenses and using those is perfectly acceptable. I've used still photography lenses for very high-end projects with no complaints whatsoever. If it comes to like specific recommendations, if we're talking about saving money, if we're talking about doing it on a budget, I really like Nikon vintage still photography lenses. They are a great choice for the price. That would be my go-to for low-end purchases. But obviously you can spend any amount. Zeiss has a lot of credibility in the industry. They make still photography lenses that are a bit more expensive, but still totally affordable. I think the main thing is for cinema, you want to have control, physical control over the focus and physical control over the aperture. And a lot of modern still lenses don't have those controls. It's all done in the digital camera. So by purchasing older vintage lenses, you can save some money. You can also have the physical controls that are needed to control focus, control aperture in a way that is needed for cinema.
Cinematographer Hanuman Brown Eagle. Another great guest of Filmmaking Confidential is The Enigma.
Being part of the Lollapalooza sideshow, which at that point, Lollapalooza was a, amazing thing, 92, should have been called the William Morris Agency Sideshow, because they're the ones that put us all around the world. And I became the most famous tattooed man in history because of that. I remember we opened for Nine Inch Nails in Madison Square Garden, two sold out nights. And, you know, I stayed in a squat in the freezing cold.
You can get a link to my full interview with The Enigma at filmmakingconfidential.com or by subscribing for free to this podcast. When we come back, Hanuman will discuss special effects, long work days, and the importance of sleep and self-care. Plus, we'll take questions from the audience listening in to our conversation right after this. You're listening to the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. I'm Steve Balderson, back now with today's guest, cinematographer Hanuman Brown Eagle.
Well, certainly, I always prefer to do things in camera as much as possible, just because to my eye, there's a more organic feel. Now, with the right artist in post, they can emulate anything that I can do, theoretically, when it comes to lenses or looks, but a lot of times that falls short if you don't have a ton of money to spend on an amazing artist in post-production. So the idea of getting the image in terms of lighting, in terms of lenses, as close as possible in the field on set, that's definitely my preference. You mentioned the project in Maine. We definitely were going for a real dreamy look, especially for some of the sequences. And for that, we used these lenses, again, designed for still photography, but also used in cinema. They're a company called Lens Baby, and they make a dozen different flavors of effects lenses. That the ones that we were using basically create, you know, like a very extreme vignette of soft focus around the outer edge of the image. And not just that, but all kinds of chromatic aberration and artifacting that you wouldn't necessarily normally want, but depending on the feel that you're going for, in that case, it was really exactly what we wanted. And we got pretty close to where we were going in camera, which was nice. But I think you remember, we quickly found that those lenses had their limitations in terms of control. So you kind of have to balance usability with the effect. Sometimes the effect can hinder the usability of the image. So we had to use those lenses sparingly for certain scenes and not use them all the time.
Right. Do you think is it the job of the cinematographer to be cautious of how it might be edited together, or crossing the line, or certain things like that? Or do you think it's, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, in my opinion, yes. I think part of the cinematographer's job is to have the director's back, to double check the director. You know, in a 2 week or a 3 week shoot, at some point even the greatest director might get confused about camera placement. And so I think it is always important to have a second set of eyes, making sure that the shots really are going to cut together. And especially, you know, working with newer directors, it's very important. Sometimes you have to educate a newer director about why it won't work to put the camera in a certain place. And the best example is two people talking to each other. You need one of the people to look one direction and the other person to look the other direction, so that when you watch the scene, we understand one person is looking at the other person. If you get that wrong, if you put the camera in the wrong place, you got both actors looking at the same direction, the effect will be, it will look like one of them is looking at the other one's, the back of the other one's head. It'll look like they're sitting tandem. So yeah, just by simple camera placement, it's camera placement that allows the audience to understand the geography of the scene. And the whole point of that is just so that they can stop thinking and enjoy the story. And if camera placement is not perfect, then it becomes a distraction. And so, yes, to me, I don't know how anyone works as a cinematographer without having a background in editing, because I am constantly imagining the edit to make sure that each shot will cut together. And that's one of the places where I have some real input. You know, the director will decide where the camera goes, but the director decides broadly, and then the cinematographer has the ability to test within that 1 square foot. I can move 6 inches to the right, 6 inches to the left, up, down, and I can find that perfect frame that will cut perfectly with the previous frame. And, you know, meanwhile, the director can direct while I'm doing that.
What's your favorite accessory? Steadicam, dolly, handheld, tripod, crane, jib, bib, things, like all of them. What's your favorite to play with? Or what are your least favorites?
Favorite to play with is a good way to say it. I mean, it is fun to play with toys, but again, I mean, I sound like a broken record. For me, it really is all about the director's vision. I mean, I've done films that were entirely handheld because that was the aesthetic that we were going for. And so on that film, my favorite thing was a handheld rig that, you know, kept the camera balanced on my shoulder. I always go back to, you know, what are we trying to accomplish? It's fun to play with toys. Toys are fun. But I don't get caught up in that at all, really. I'm always thinking about what we're trying to accomplish as opposed to what flashy shots we can get.
Thank you for saying that, because sometimes I can tell when someone has just purchased a new crane, you know, because it's like in every single scene.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Tell me your stance on rhythm of shots or the importance of a close-up, the importance of a wide shot, when you could do with one or without the other, things like that.
Yeah, that's harder to answer just because I do feel like it's more the territory of the director. It's really about, again, understanding where is the director coming from, what exactly are they, what kind of story are they trying to tell, and how to best tell it. I love close-ups. I think as a movie watcher, you know, fast forward through a Steven Spielberg movie and you will see that it's 95% close-ups of faces, and the other 5% is establishing shots and master shots and whatever. But to me, the medium of telling stories visually, we understand stories by the way that the actors react to the events as opposed to seeing the events. You know, we don't need to see somebody die. We need to see the person who loves them reacting to them dying. And that's in a close-up. So for me, the close-up, yes. I mean, the close-up is kind of the bread and butter of movies because it's where we find out what's really going on.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because also there is something about, maybe it was Karen Black. Somebody told me. She's always the one who I go to. She's the one, whether she said it or not. It's all in the eyes. Yeah. And if you can't see the person's eyes, you know, if you're too far, if the shot's way back here, the emotional reading on my face is totally different than when I'm like this.
Yeah, you just illustrated it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. And I've seen some early filmmakers, you know, in their first, second, or third films, have a really important scene that's like in a wide shot and I can't see. Are they crying? It sounds like they're crying, but I can't see them. They're only this big.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a radical choice to play out a scene in a wide. And sometimes it works great. It really depends a lot on the scene, of course, but generally speaking, yeah. I mean, movies, I think any movies, if you really start analyzing them, you'll find that movies are mostly close-ups because that's where we really learn what's happening and what's happening to the characters.
Tell us, without naming names, and it could be stories about other people that you've heard of, you know, like other cinematographers or other camera people or other just crew or actors that have been on film sets. Compare the different kinds of film sets you've been on. You know, the sizes, whether it's from, you know, how many, the smallest one, the biggest one, the smallest budget, the biggest budget, the nicest or the meanest? You know, give us some flavor of your working experience for the past years and years of what it's like in the world out there and the variety that actually exists.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that came to mind immediately is just how things have changed over the last, my first feature I shot in 2005. So that's 15 years. So in the last 15 years, a lot has changed from my perspective, especially in the indie film world, but also on the commercial side. As cameras have gotten more sensitive to light, lighting budgets have been reduced, and along with that, crew budgets have been reduced. So when I got started, I mean, the first feature I did, we shot principal for something like 35 days, and we had a huge crew and tons of equipment, massive setups, all stuff that we could do with today's technology for quite a bit less and quite a bit more simply. That doesn't necessarily mean it's always that way. I was doing a job, just some really tiny web-based commercial work where we had a massive crew. You know, I had five people in lighting, five people in grip. So I had a team of 10 just working on grip and lighting, plus another three on the camera department and so on and so forth. I mean, and that was overkill, but it just kind of depends, I think, on, I mean, budget obviously is a huge factor, but I would say on the low budget side for indie films, it's possible to do more with less more than ever. And it can be done that way. I keep throwing the ball into the court of the director. It does depend on the director. You know, it depends on whether the director's vision is achievable on a small scale or whether it requires a larger scale.
Well, let me,
a lot to that question. I don't know. What direction would you like to go with it?
Well, let's just stay right there, because I realize that as you're explaining all this to me, I'm like, that was like an hour's worth of question. Like, we can't even like unpack that question, really, because I asked too many. Well, here's the thing. So in my new book, Filmmaking Confidential, there is a thing in here about people take up space. And that's just a fact. You know, whether you've got millions and millions of dollars or $0, it doesn't change the fact that people take up space. So, you know, if you're working on a set and you're in a room and you're in somebody's apartment and you're doing a scene with, you know, three people, three actors, and it's time you're getting everything set up, you don't have all that much room to move around each other. You know, once you've got the cameras and the lights and the things and the rig set up, there isn't all that much space for people to be. You know, right. So it's on one hand, it's my personal preference to keep crews as low as possible. Now, I've the largest crew that I've directed a film with was 42 people.
Yeah.
And the smallest was, what was it, 7?
Yeah, very small.
Right, 7 or 8. Both which produced great results. You know, both didn't cost less or more necessarily. It was just, there were just different amounts of people. You know, when I don't know the facts about, you know, when Tom and Nicole are in England shooting Eyes Wide Shut with Kubrick, you know, how many people were really there on that stage, on that set, on that, at that moment all day long? You know, I'm sure there were some people, but something tells me, because he operated his camera himself,
yes,
that there were very few people.
Yeah, it's likely. It's likely that there were. I don't happen to know, but it is likely that there were. It's also likely that there were 50 people, you know, in a holding area.
Right, like, yeah, just off.
Yeah, exactly. For days and days and days, just in case. I mean, I don't know. It depends. But certainly, I think about that, you know, I wonder why there isn't more of a flexible crew size. You know, typically a film will crew up and keep that crew for the duration. I think one trick on low budget films is to have a flexible crew, to have a core crew, and then to bring in extra day players on the bigger days. And it seems like it's rare that that's actually done in my experience, but it seems like it's a good way to save money. And yeah, a good way to take up less space, like you said. And of course, you know, now we live in a different world and that's going to have an impact on what you're talking about. You know, on larger films, they're working with zones and, you know, certain areas, and you have to be cleared to be in that particular zone. And so I think, you know, even if everything goes back to normal, I think that will influence how we do things going forward. And we will see, you know, less people actually on the set when the talent is on set, regardless of how many people are actually working on the film.
You know this, and Doug, who is watching us, can attest to this. Because the way I schedule, promise typically to never exceed shooting 12 hours.
Yes.
In a work day.
Yeah.
And I have, maybe with the exception of once we went 12 and a half, I don't know when that would have been. I mean, maybe, but I was going to say, well, I know since 2006, I've never exceeded a 12-hour workday. Yeah. Whether you were the DP on that film or not, what is the longest workday you ever filmed for someone?
I mean, okay, yes. I'll start by saying, yeah, in my experience with you, I believe we've shot 3 feature films together and a handful of music videos, and we've never gone past 12. But the thing is, we usually don't go past 10 or 10 and a half. Yeah. And that makes you, you know, a unicorn. 12 and a half is typical. 12 and a half is typical. They want to squeeze every drop out without going past that mark. But I've done long days. I mean, on my first feature, I think day 2 was 18.5, 19 hours. Yeah, with a, you know, 7-hour turnaround or something. And the issue there is that it's just not safe. I mean, yeah, it's all fine and great to, you know, explore and create your vision to the fullest, but not when it risks people's lives driving home. You know, I think that's what it really comes down to. But the other thing is, it's so important to be aware, and a lot of directors, maybe cinematographers, aren't aware of what it's like for the crew, what their experience is. And it's so important, you know, when you're managing a team, it's important to be able to empathize with them and understand what they are facing, what they are going through. So for me, an 18.5, 19-hour day, it actually isn't so bad because I'm so into it. But I know the people that I'm working with are not into it. and that should be respected. So, I think out of respect for the people who are helping you make it possible, and then out of just general safety concerns, I don't think that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I think there are some people who like it because they're getting overtime, they're getting, you know, all these other benefits, and maybe they don't mind having such low sleep. But I think safety is a big concern. And I think even if you want to make more money and you're doing overtime or you're doing whatever, you'll probably hurt somebody or hurt yourself.
Yeah.
And then it's no good. I have, you know, take care of your people, let them sleep well, let them eat well. And then you make the best. You know, I feel like sometimes our 10-hour workday is like other people's 14-hour workdays.
Well, yes, there is that case to be made for diminishing returns, where you're extremely productive for the first 10 or 12 hours. But then after that, how productive are you really when you're that exhausted? And so I wonder, you know, if it's possible maybe to actually be more productive by getting a great night's sleep, working for a reasonable amount of time, and then going home and doing it all over again, as opposed to just constantly burning out. I would say, with every feature that I've done, I've learned more and more tricks to get more rest, stay more well-rested. And really, in general, I think one of the things that people can do to help their work is focus on self-care, focus on making sure that you're well-rested, well-fed, and then when you are at work, you're able to deliver in a more meaningful way.
I would love to know, how do you like working or not working with storyboards? Because you haven't mentioned that. And I think that's a fascinating thing for a director and a cinematographer too. So what's your take on that? Is it a positive? Is it a negative?
Yeah, that's a great question. there are pros and cons. I think that it works both ways. I think when I got started earlier on, not having storyboards made me extremely nervous. There's two ways from a technical standpoint, there's kind of two different ways that I'll approach a project. One is either I will have a set of equipment that will serve me in any situation. And the other way to work is to know exactly what each shot is going to be via storyboards and location scouts, and then to have very specific tools for those specific shots. And as far as which one yields a better result, you know, when it comes to your typical small film, I'm not sure. Now, when it comes to bigger films or bigger scenes, certainly on a larger, more complex scene, storyboards are great for being able to understand exactly what's trying to be accomplished so that when you get there, you're not missing some important tool that you need. You know, then on the creative side, it's hard to say. So when I'm working with storyboards, it gives me more time to think about how am I going to light the scene. I can develop lighting design based on the storyboards, and then I can sleep on it. And I'll wake up the next day and I'll say, oh no, that's all wrong, and I'll do it all over again. Mm-hmm. And then we get to set, and then I've already thought about it a few times. I've come up with what works and what doesn't in my head. I get there and then I can execute what I've come up with. Although even then, sometimes on the day, I'll make a different choice. So,
or we'll have, for instance, Kim has a question we'll get to. Just one second, Kim. So okay. I always do storyboards. And then we get on set, and you've planned the storyboards, you've designed it, you've all done all this stuff, and then I decide we're not going to look at them at all, and we're going to do this. Right. Way over here. And you're just like,
I remember that.
that makes sense too, though, because there's such a magic that comes from what comes in the moment as opposed to what you planned ahead to do. So, yeah, I mean, I struggle to really say one is better than the other. But certainly, you know, when you're blowing up a car, and you've got the fire department there, and you know, all of these different elements, it's nice to walk into that knowing where's the camera going to go and where am I going to put my lights, certainly, because, yeah, I would just say the more complex it gets, the more necessary storyboards become.
Kim, what's your question?
Oh, okay. My question to Hahnemann, you guys were talking about, I think, like close-up shots, which I thought was really interesting. I think you're saying Steven Spielberg movies. I guess my question is, you know, when I've watched a lot of older movies, they're obviously shot in a 1.33 to the 1 versus, you know, today's movies, which are widescreen. But my question about the close-up is, do you feel like, I feel like those older movies, I see more of their eyes or their close-ups because of the aspect ratio. Do you have a preference of the aspect ratio, or do you think there's one that's better or worse when you do eye shots or close-up shots? I guess, kind of piggybacking off of you guys' thing about, you know, close-up and eyes are very important in shots.
Yeah. That's a really good question. I think, yeah, there's something to that. That 4x3 or 1.33 to 1, I mean, it's more rectangular. You can get more face in it. You know, if you're at 16x9 or 2.35 to 1, you've got all this empty space on the sides. So you do end up, you know, yes, like you said, absolutely seeing less of the face. For me, I think you can still get close enough with any aspect ratio, but I know what you mean. And especially if you couple that with these older films that you mentioned, not only are they in this aspect ratio that serves the more of the portrait style, but also great care was taken in those films with the portraits. You know, typically we will, you know, we'll light a scene and shoot it and not take a lot of effort with the close-up to necessarily make it different than the wide shot. In those old films, they would completely relight for their close-ups and make them these, you know, ultimate glamour, different filtration, different lenses, different lighting just for those close-ups. And I think that's part of why I think we kind of, in some of those films, why we see more in their faces. But aspect ratio is a funny thing. You know, if I'm trying to show you how tall a building is, then the modern aspect ratio of 2.35 to 1 is almost impossible. Because how can I show you how tall anything is when my frame is shaped like this? You know, nothing looks tall. And that's where, this is an interesting thing, that's where you can actually create, as a cinematographer, you can create any aspect ratio within any other aspect ratio. So if I'm shooting 2:3:5:1, I can place foreground objects on either side that then only allow a 4:3 image in the center of that. And then I could show a tall building in the middle of that space. And so I think that's an element of it. So like in an over the shoulder on a wide aspect ratio, you know, if it's just a single shot, then you've got this head and then all this empty space. But if it's an over the shoulder, you can use the body of the person whose shoulder you're shooting over to essentially darken out 2/3 of the image. And then you're left with this square that's more like that older aspect ratio that you mentioned. So I think it is, it's something that you can play with. You can actually, you know, temporarily by using foreground elements, create different aspect ratios within your master aspect ratio. And I think that gets utilized a lot just to draw more attention to whatever the subject is.
I think master cinematographer is a perfect way to describe Hanuman Brown Eagle. Tune in next time for more Filmmaking Confidential. It is totally free to subscribe, and when you subscribe, you'll get upcoming new episodes automatically, and you'll have free access to all our past shows. The Filmmaking Confidential podcast is a production of Dakanga Audio and produced by myself and Ella Spencer. Our theme music is composed by Kevin Robles. For more of the Filmmaking Confidential podcast, head over to filmmakingconfidential.com. If you have a question about filmmaking you'd like answered on the podcast, send me an email using the contact form on the website. To learn more of my filmmaking secrets, be sure to pick up a copy of the book, Filmmaking Confidential, available on Audible, paperback, and ebook, wherever books are sold. I'm Steve Balderson. Thanks for listening and spreading the word. Until next time, keep making, keep doing, keep going.